ground.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds fit, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville.
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
Hello, I'm Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. Today on Prof Talk, we continue a panel discussion from experts from the UBC Departments of Economics and Political Science. It was put on last October to discuss the major factors leading up to the current economic meltdown. The panel was called Balance and Blow Up, an analysis of the current financial crisis. Today you will hear the two remaining members of the panel, first Dr. Angela Reddish from the Department of Economics, and second Dr. Yves Tibergian from the Department of Political Science. The panel was moderated by Dean of Arts Nancy Galini, whose voice you hear in their introductions.
Angie is a professor in the Economics Department. She is an expert on the history of money and has written extensively on the origins of the Bank of Canada, the history of the Canadian banking system, and the origins of the gold standard. Angie has served as special advisor to the Bank of Canada and is a member of the C.D. Howe Monetary Policy Council, which is a group of academic and private sector economists who regularly make public recommendations on monetary policy just in advance of the Bank of Canada's interest rate announcements. So as an economic historian, Angie will be able to tell us how similar 2009 will be to 1929.
Okay, just to remind you, what was the Great Depression? I think most people time it from late 1929, and in particular from the collapse of the stock market in October 1929. And it was a dire and dismal decade. The picture of the soup kitchen that I had on the first slide was not an unusual sight in the United States in the early 1930s. In both Canada and the United States, unemployment rates were of the order of magnitude of 25% for a long time. Real per capita incomes fell about a third. That's real, so that's adjusted for kind of deflation that happened. And it didn't happen evenly. In Canada and the prairies, incomes fell to 10% of their values that they had been in the 20s. So this was a really dramatic episode. The stock market crashes, this was one of those warning things. What you can see is that both the Dow Jones Index and the TSE both fell dramatically after 1929. What I think you have to remember is that even though it fell by about 25% in October 1929, the stock markets kept falling through 1930. During 1930, after the stock market crash of October 1929, the market fell a further 50%. In 1931, it fell another 25%. Okay, so the markets kept falling. You shouldn't think that it's once it's fallen, it's going to stabilize and everything will necessarily be fine. Maybe, like 1987, yes, maybe not. Actually, the economic historians have been kind of puzzled about, even though there was a huge stock market decline, did it necessarily transfer into declines in the real economy? And I think the leading explanation that economists have at the moment is that in 1930 itself, there was a collapse of consumer spending. Okay? And that collapse was even bigger than what you would expect from the stock market decline. And it was as though consumers were just nervous. Okay? So it wasn't just a multiplier effect of falling income. It was the result of nervousness, and most likely nervousness because people didn't know where the stock market was going to go. They didn't know where the economy was going to go. And that collapse of consumer spending, particularly on durable goods, okay? Because with durable goods, you don't have to say, I'm not going to eat today. You just say, I'm not going to buy a refrigerator today. I'll wait and see if things get better and buy it tomorrow. So that kind of option of waiting for a day or two, repeated, kind of explains some of the collapse of consumption in 1930. Now, the other thing is that in the U.S., that collapse of consumption, the collapse of the stock market, combined with a very fragile banking system, led to huge collapses of the banking system. So 9,000 banks suspended payments. By 1933, essentially, they closed all the banks in the United States. So you start with kind of a stock market crash, halt in consumer spending, banking crisis. Okay. Now, the good news is that Canada didn't have that banking crisis. In Canada, the banks were fairly robust, as they are today. The bad news is that if you look at the real economic indicators in Canada, they look just as bad as those in the United States. That even in 1930, 1931, Canada was not insulated. Canada's economy depended on the health of the U.S. economy, and when the U.S. economy was not healthy, Canada was in very bad shape. Canadian exports fell. Investment, you can see, investment fell by nearly 80%. All right. Now, we'd had a very successful investment decade in the 20s, but that's just sort of the order of magnitude. The other thing to sort of emphasize a little bit on the side here is that sort of at least some people who are in the financial markets and we're sort of thinking liquidity crisis, credit crisis, but the world doesn't actually wait to allow you. In economic models, you probably learn that you have one shock and this is what it will do. Well, in the real economy, things pile on. And in the 1930s, what piled on was the Dust Bowl and a very severe agricultural crisis. Okay, so now we're coming to kind of the more good news stories. And in particular, what I want to say is that I think that policymakers, economists, historians, we've actually learned something since the 1930s. And there are more policy levers, and we know better how to use them and when to use them than in the 1930s. Eichen Green, who was referred to, I think, by Mick, wrote a book about the Great Depression, which he called Golden Fetters. And he argued that the policy responses in the 1930s were completely constrained by the fact that most Western economies were on the gold standard. And what that meant was that governments committed and central banks committed to turn their banknotes and their bank deposits into gold. And because of that commitment, they couldn't be a, well, let's print money and try to resolve the problem. Let's issue government debt. Let's spend some money, because every dollar there had to be gold to back every dollar. And that belief that there had to be gold to back every dollar constrained both monetary and fiscal policy. Okay. Today we're not in that world. And that's enabled the Federal Reserve and the Bank of Canada to undertake all kinds of creative ways to try to get liquidity into the markets, and things would have been vastly worse if they had not done so. And just to wrap that up, in 1933, when Roosevelt became president, he suspended the gold standard. He just said, we will not convert our notes and deposits into gold. And that allowed him to do things that restarted the economy. In March 1933, when Roosevelt took office, is sort of the beginning of the recovery from the Great Depression. Okay. The other thing that I think we've learned about policy, which I hope we've learned about policy, is the need for international cooperation. In the 1930s, as each government was kind of struggling with the Depression, they instituted policies to try to help their economy. In Canada, we kind of depreciated the exchange rate. In the U.S., they put on a big tariff called the Smoot-Hawley tariff. You may have heard references to recently. So policies which, in retrospect, have been called beggar-thy-neighbor policies. Every country did it, and it didn't make any country better off because it only makes you better off relative to the other countries. But if everybody does it, you're not going to get any relatively better off. And, in fact, you're doing things that are going to harm the economy. Okay. The result, and this has been very much in the news, coming out, as you know, the Depression more or less continued. In Canada, real GDP did not come up to its 1929 level until 1939. Canada entered World War II in 1939. Okay. During World War II, towards the end of World War II in 1944, governments in the U.S., the U.K., and Canada, France, tried to get together to say, how can we design institutions so that we don't get into that beggar-thy-neighbor world again? And that was the Bretton Woods Conference in New Hampshire in 1944, where institutions like the IMF and WTO were first put together as ways to try to say, we've got to not get into those beggar-thy-neighbor policies, which were destructive for everybody, didn't help anybody. Okay, final thoughts. I think that many economists and most economic historians would see the Great Depression as really a turning point in economic policy making in North America. Okay, and in particular, it was a moment of crisis because people who up until the 1930s or till 1929 believed that the market was kind of able to regulate itself, that things that the market did, that the market was a good thing, people began to have serious doubts. If you have unemployment of 20-25% for a decade, that's telling you the market is not able to do things by itself. So the Great Depression was a watershed in how people think about the role of the government in the economy. It led to a number of things. I put a few of them down here. The idea of activist stabilization policy, the use of monetary policy and fiscal policy to mitigate business cycles. The expanded role of the government, all the automatic stabilizers, which I haven't talked about, but which, again, were not there in the late 1920s, early 1930s, but that we have today. Unemployment insurance, social insurance. Deposit insurance came in the United States with FDR in 1933. International institutions. So today I think we do have policy tools that will enable us, which mitigate as opposed to eliminate business cycle and financial crises, and then monetary policy, fiscal policy, and international policy coordination.
And finally, keeping the economist honest is a political scientist. So that's how bad it's become. Yves Tabergian. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science, and Eve was trained at Stanford and Harvard and specializes in Japanese, Chinese, European, and comparative political economy. His pioneering book on financial globalization and corporate governance reforms was published in 2007 in the prestigious Cornell series in political economy. A former visiting scholar at the Japanese Ministry of Finance and Japan Foundation's fellow, Eve is a foremost expert in Canada on the Japanese financial crisis of the 1990s and on the politics of the Asian crisis. Eve's expert grasp of global political economy also comes from stints at Korea University with the French Treasury and from exhaustive research periods at the European Union and in China.
Okay, so I'm going to shift to the sphere of both the origin and the solution to the crisis. Politics and governance. And when Nancy was introducing me just before Angie Reddish moved to, that's the end of it. That's the end. Angie was turning toward me and said, good luck when when my role is to keep the economists honest, right? So that's the difficult challenge, but I'm going to move to the sphere of governance and argue that global finance has been an enduring Achilles heel in the regulation of the global economy for nearly 200 years. And this is just the latest episode of that trouble. So you have a little illustration of this. I'll be very quick over the diagnostics, since I will be mostly repackaging the assets of my previous speakers, but say a bit more about root causes, which is really about the dilemmas of the governance of global finance, turn to geopolitical aspects of the crisis and the current shift in the global balance of power that accompanies and makes it more difficult to solve this crisis. I'll say a word about where we stand right now. You know, did we solve it last week or not? What may still happen? And I also want to speak about the current move, the strong energy, the strong push toward creating a new Bretton Woods system, which I call the Qingdao One system, to take a Chinese equivalent of the Bretton Woods location, a nice idyllic place not too far from the capital, and then have some closing thoughts on this. So in terms of what we have now, it's really a perfect storm, as was mentioned by Paul. At the very narrow level, we know the stories about bubbles, several bubbles at the same time, and leverage, housing, finance, banking, etc. So a housing bubble fueled by risky, under-regulated mortgages that were repackaged into securities and sold widely to banks and others around the globe. So we had basically the socialization of risk, you know, at a very high speed. This was accompanied at the same time by very high levels of debt in the U.S. So we could talk of a credit bubble. In the midst of this, we could say that rating agencies failed. They didn't manage to value those assets, and therefore they valued them as safe, and they got a lot of investors buying things that were more risky than they thought. We add to this stock market bubbles around the globe, and finally a global commodity and energy bubble coming at the same time. So this is where we were. Lots of bubbles, a mega bubble. And this is where we have been over the last few days and weeks. The housing bubble popped first, which you know, started with the subprime mortgage crisis. Then a bank insurance, you know, we moved to a crisis where banks, insurance companies, mortgage companies got bankrupt, which led to a liquidity crisis and into a banking market that was frozen. That's still, well, it's just unfreezing today, maybe. Maybe not anymore. And then in turn turning to a credit crunch over the last 2 weeks, leading to a confident crisis and stock market plunge. The week of October 5, 10 alone had essentially a 20% drop around the globe. And then we're not sure it's finished. You know, several economists, Royal Rubini, the perpetual negative or pessimistic economist, has predicted that the next dominoes would be the hedge funds, or shadow the, more of the shadow banking system. And we also are holding our breath when it comes to the mega potential crisis, the issue of solvency of the U.S. And several economists have predicted in Europe a solvency crisis in the U.S. by summer 2009 and the potential collapse of the dollar. So that's the still that's the secondary stage of the crisis that we haven't seen, but that's always that big question mark hanging over there. A context, as colleagues have mentioned, bubbles are not new. Lots of books have been written, one of them by Kinder Burger, called Mania's Panics and Crashes, which is a great read right now. And essentially, you know, it goes over hundreds of serious, you know, similar bubbles, showing that everything starts with a displacement, innovation, a boom, and then spread internationally, a stampede, revulsion, and finally, when you reach revulsion, you absolutely need to have government intervention, otherwise the system will disintegrate entirely. So we know about this. That's a historical example. But what's special also about this particular crisis is that it happens within another cluster of global issues. One, of course, is that it comes on the heels of a period of 30 years of deregulation around the world, where a lot of the national protections, particularly in stakeholder capitalist countries, that is non-US, not Canada, but the rest of the OECD, most of it, you know, started to undo a lot of the protections of the economy, and especially around the banking system that were put in place after the war as a response to the global crisis. We also fall here in terms of timing at the end of an economic cycle, at a period of trade uncertainty when the Doha trade round just collapsed, in part it collapsed because of protectionism in the U.S., in Europe, Canada, mostly U.S. and Europe actually, also Japan, and also because of a shifting balance of power with the rise of countries like China, India, Brazil, demanding more say in the governance of the trade structures. We also, at the same time, have had a global food and energy crisis, and all this is happening at a time when the U.S. hegemonic leadership, which has been behind the structuration of the whole global economy, is weak, in part because of war constraints, in part because of transition from one presidency to the other, and also because of the loss of soft power in the wake of the Iraq War, etc. This is an interesting graph about the bond holdings. This is, you know, about 25-30% of the U.S. bonds are held by foreigners. That's a total right now at the end of August, $2.7 trillion. Of those, you see in blue, Japan is number one with 21%. China is almost 20 plus 2.2 with Hong Kong. So China and Japan are more holding above 40% of it. Britain has 11%. And increasingly, you know, as the U.S. has already a $500 billion a year deficit and is bailing out, you know, and is committing a lot more money that it doesn't have, well, those countries have to chip in more and more money. Of course, they depend on, you know, big current account surpluses to the U.S., so they have to do it. But at the same time, how do we gauge what their reactions is going to be? If you read now Chinese papers, you're going to find more and more arguments coming from Chinese intellectuals and economists that China should exact a price from this. That this is time maybe to ask, maybe to sit down with the U.S. and ask to transform a lot of those bonds into equity, into more voice into the governance structures. Or, you know, there should be a price in terms of Taiwan and Tibet. You find those chat room debates right now in China, and that's another uncertainty in the background. Now, what's the root cause of the crisis? The root cause, and that's where I bring a political scientist argument, is this elusive quest for the global governance of finance. Global finance has presented us with a historical dilemma. In order to get a low cost of capital, as Paul mentioned, we need to accept a degree of volatility and risk that's often beyond what the average people are happy with. In general, it is not done publicly, so de facto we have socialization of risk. We have a moral hazard where the risks are taken anyway by the financial industry without a full understanding by the rest of of us. And then at the time of crisis, then the government has to chip in with taxpayers' money. In 1944, at the Bretton Woods period, the decision was made to lower the risk of finance by restricting global capital and instead to emphasize free trade. Post-1980s, we have moved the other way by deregulating finance, but the deregulation of finance creates a big dilemma because the paradox is to deregulate finance, you need to create new regulations in order to monitor and supervise the new world. And this is difficult to do because there is a lot of asymmetry here and collective action problem, where the actors usually can agree on deregulating and giving the carrots, but they cannot agree on the stick part of the bargain. So in most cases, as we saw in emerging markets in the 90s, you end up having ill-supervised deregulation. That's what has plagued the process of financial deregulation time and time again. I'll move forward. So in terms of where we are now, I feel the wheels of destiny are shifting. We are in the midst of a geopolitical shift. This crisis is happening in the midst of what we call in political science a hegemonic transition, with the decline of the U.S. relative to others and the rise of China as a potential future hegemon. So we have a shift in balance of power as well as a diffusion of power. And at the moment, essentially, it's the EU that's calling the shots, that has pushed the frontier of regulation by bringing forward the formula that's now winning and by also pushing forward on the whole argument around New Bretton Woods. China holds, however, the future balance of power and holds a lot of the clues for the treasury, the treasuries in the U.S. Japan also holds huge financial weight. So those are the key actors now that have to sit down and work with the U.S. We know that case-by-case responses did not work. What has worked was the coordinated central bank approach, as well as coordinated injections into banks and deposit guarantees. Where we are now and what may still happen, we at the moment, given the scale of government interventions and the coordination of it, unprecedented at G7 level, I think we're past the depression stage. At the same time, there's still uncertainty in terms of global currency markets and how the U.S. solvency will be affected or not in 2009. We also tend to feel that new global regulations will be needed to regain full confidence in the market and to provide the right signals. So are we moving toward the new Bretton Woods 2 or Qingdao 1? What we know is there have been a set of dramatic proposals, starting with Sarkozy at the UN, September 23, with thunderous applause at the General Assembly, followed by a very precise proposal by Gordon Brown and the Camp David Summit just last Sunday. Now there's been a decision to move forward with a series of summits. So there's a strong push around the world, but resistance still from the U.S. hegemon on this. To conclude, this is a crisis that was long predicted, that is not a surprise. At core, it's a crisis of the global governance of finance and ill-supervised deregulation. We are in a situation where new technology in finance and global financial markets operate beyond the reach of regulation in a highly volatile spheres, and they have benefited from fragmentation of political regimes. The outcome has been a crisis of moral hazard, socialization of risks. I think that we're going to need a new global regime, even though it's very difficult to create this at the time of hegemonic transition. At the moment, the EU is pushing the frontier, and I think Canada should join in that process more actively than it has.
This is Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM on the Point Grey campus in Vancouver. If you would like to send us feedback of this show, please email us at proftalk@gmail.com. Or for an updated schedule, visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also listen to the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I am Farha Khan. Talk to you next week.
CITR 101.9 FM is your home for live UBC sports.
Second down and 18 for the Clan at row 37. We got our streaker.
Here's the streaker.
Davies dropped back. He's got a throw.
Throw it
now
to
he's gonna
streaker.
Run with it. And the streaker, I think, got Simon Fraser a first down. And we got security getting after him. He's into the Sam, you call it.
He's into the end zone, and he's breakdancing in the end zone bare naked. He's being chased by security, and he's
going for the
hill. Security fell down.
Go.
Security is coming.
He's going for
get
the
get up
injury.
The fence.
Oh, he's going.
You got to love college football.
Did I mention it is also unedited and commercial-free?
He's going to put his team shorthanded.
As smart as your mom was when she decided not to take birth control.
Well, there you have it.
All the information about our sports department can be found on our website, citr.ca.
Hey, how you doing? This is Sean from Youth Brigade. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
What are we alive for except to grab all the kicks we can?
CITR 101.9 Vancouver.
It makes you feel real big.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to... Fun!
While
fun
cloaks itself in a plethora of disguises, its favorite mantle still remains.
Fun. Fun.
Devours all it touches, its voracious appetite rarely fulfilled. Yet
fun
does not only destroy.